We are going to start. So I am absolutely thrilled to welcome you to this second edition of the Blockchain for Good UN Conference. Welcome everyone. So my name is Jacques-André Finch-Lomberger. I am Head of Operation at Blockchain for Good. And before diving into the identity and privacy conversation, I would like to say a few words about the association and the format of this conversation. So, Blockchain for Good is a non-profit organization, general interest, a collective of researchers, entrepreneurs, civil society who have been making research about this topic since 2018 now. Topics between blockchain and SDGs, and we mainly have three means of action: data, event, report. So data, very easy. We collect data about impact projects built on public blockchains, and we release them as an open data set. First mean of action. Second one, reports, rewrites, acculturation reports, by sector of activity, and the idea is to be understandable by anyone, so even if you are not an expert. These reports are independent and neutral written, and they are published under Creative Commons license. And, of course, the third mean of action is events. We organize small events in Paris or bigger events like this one. And again, this idea, the idea behind these events is to build bridges between the entire For Good ecosystem, blockchain or not related. So today we will have the opportunity to discuss four major worldwide challenges. We are going to talk about digital identity and privacy this morning. Then we will talk about an open conversation about food, water, energy, and supply chain. Really interesting. And then the afternoon, we will have the first conversation will be about climate and environment. And the second one will be about peer-to-peer money for good. So this will be absolutely fascinating. Our association and the Blockchain for Good UN Conference would not have been possible without the academic, financial, and human support of the Institut Louis Bachelier here. Blockchain at Polytechnique from École Polytechnique in France, Groupe Caisse des Dépôts, BPI France, and Crédit Agricole Corporate Investment Bank. So we warmly thank them for giving us the opportunity to conduct research on such topics. So before diving into the first conversation, I would like to share a few practical informations with you. So the conversation will be recorded and broadcast as a podcast later. So if you don't want to be recorded, please do not speak. I will start by introducing the context of our conversation, 10 minutes, no more. And then I will give the stage to our special guests so that they can also contribute to this context of this open conversation. And then we will all discuss together during 50 to 60 minutes. Thanks to you and the facilitators of the Blockchain for Good Association. So to ensure that everything goes as smoothly as possible, I ask you to follow these simple rules. Please only speak into a microphone. As you know, we are recorded. Keep it concise, of course, and don't hug it, don't squat it. Please give also your name and eventually the first time you speak the name of your organization. And it's not a rule, but enjoy the end conference format and let's make the most of this unique opportunity to learn from one another. So now, let's begin for 10 minutes of introduction about this topic, digital identity and privacy. So, the question of identity, identification and authentication varies significantly across the globe, depending on one's personal and geographical circumstances. While approximately 1 billion individuals lack the ability to prove their identity due to institutional failures, the remainder of humanity appears unable to safeguard their own identities for commercial and financial reasons, surveillance capitalism, and also for political and security reasons, anti-money laundering, and AML and CFT, so combating the finances, the financing of terrorism. So, however, in 2024, digital identity is in a state of disruption. Really. Between the exponential acceleration of artificial intelligence and the new European Union digital identity wallet becoming a law, the pressure and opportunities for breakthroughs in decentralized identity are unprecedented. It's not my words. They are from Rebooting the Web of Trust, a movement that experts know very well, a conference and movement about decentralized web technologies since 2017. So just to be sure that anyone can understand something, at least at the beginning, about this topic, I would like to first present the key concepts around decentralized identity in a simple and a clear manner. So let's start with a fundamental question. What is digital identity? So as you know, the term digital identity refers to the ability to securely use one's identity attributes to access a set of resources. The simplest definition I have. So identity is what allows us to prove who we are. And in the daily life, this can be a passport, this can be an ID card, or any other official documents. And in the digital world, identity takes a different form but serves exactly the same purpose, to allow us to prove our identity, access online services, and interact securely with others. So the principle of online identification currently relies on the fact that online services collect the personal data of their customers, patients, constituents, graduates, citizens, etc. This is known as the centralized digital identity model, in which a person's identity attributes are managed in a single location by one entity that is responsible for the collection, for their security, and for their authentication, and for which this is not often the primary business, of course. And so with this model, each interaction with a new online service or new service is an opportunity to disseminate more personal information. Data theft, identity theft, undue surveillance, and the cost incurred by such system have long been of interest to engineers and cryptographers. And it's not a secret for anyone, this current model has therefore become obsolete. In contrast, decentralized digital identity is a system that allows anyone to personally store and manage the attributes of their identity issued by a third party, issuers, and to share them autonomously selectively and sometimes anonymously with other third parties, verifiers, in order to use their services and thereby regaining a form of individual sovereignty that has tended to disappear with the digitization of society today. So a decentralized digital identity system, sometimes called self-sovereign identity, proposed to reverse the current model based on authentication and access control managed by a single organization towards this tripartite model based on a collection of verifiable credentials that constitutes a person's digital identity. So a credential, is it a big word? A credential, described as verifiable, provides an online privacy-respecting mechanism for cryptographically representing these documents so that they are extremely difficult to forge and can be easily verified using a computer program. So as you can see on the image behind me, the decentralized identity model involved the interaction of three entities: the holder, you, me, an entity, an individual, an employee, who personally holds a software program called a digital wallet, and we'll talk about digital wallet after that. And this is so a digital service, an application, that allows the user to hold and manage one or more decentralized identifiers and to receive verifiable credentials associated with these identifiers. So these verifiable credentials are the digital equivalent of printed documents, such as a driver license, for example, which attests your ability to drive a vehicle, or a university degree, which attests to a level of education. It's exactly the same thing, but in an electronic way and cryptographically secured way. Second entity, the issuer, is an entity such as a company, an NGO, a government, we'll see, a university, a club, as you wish, that certifies certain fields of this identity by electronically signing the verifiable credential. It can be the age, it can be the name, the country of birth, the bank account, and so on. And then the third entity is the verifier. It's an entity such as an employer, the police, a public service, a company, whatever, that receive a verifiable credential and check it using the zero knowledge proof, and we'll talk about that either. So that CAPI is a cryptographic technique that allows one party, the holder, to prove to another party, the verifier, that they have certain characteristics or that they have performed certain actions without revealing any other information than the strict minimum. So really, the idea of implementing a protocol that transforms a blockchain into an automated, trustless access manager while ensuring that users possess, control, and manage their data gradually gain global momentum. Proof of this momentum, the diversity of our special guest with us today. We are extremely lucky to have the opportunity to talk about decentralized identity from very different perspectives, we will see. Daniel Duceuil from European Blockchain Service Infrastructure, Nena Dukozov from Ministry of Economic Development in Slovenia, Perrine de Couette-Logon, President of the Board of Directors at Open Education Global and also Registrar Directorate at University of Lille. And from the perspective, of course, of Web3 startups, with Erwin McMullen here, co-founder and CEO of Disco XYZ, Frédéric Martin, which is the CEO of MyDID, and I don't know if Phil Kelly is here. Yes, no, no. Who is a head of business of O1 Labs, Zero Knowledge Proof, so we'll see. And of course, from our perspective, user, you, me, everybody in this room, everyone in this room. And so to finish setting the context and start the discussion, I'm going to ask a question to each of our special guests, who will have, and it's a difficult exercise, I think, no more than 2 or 3 minutes to answer this first round of question, and then to discuss all together. So my question is, because you work in a very different context, what is your perspective on decentralized identity, and could you give us concrete example of real world use? So I will start with who? Who wants to start? So what is your perspective about decentralized identity, and what is the real use case you are working on in your work, in your organization? What is your perspective on this decentralized identity?
Yes, thank you very much, Jacques-André. I think the magic in the blockchain is to make people meet around one project that is decentralized. And this is why when I watched this panel, I think of the way we met Nena and Daniel and myself an infrastructure that would be shared by governments themselves in Europe. And if we did something, we wanted to have a blockchain that is really for decentralized identity and to share any certificate and verifiable credentials. And this is how we met, and we have been working towards the European blockchain service infrastructure. So my specific focus is on education. Yes, I am president of the board of Open Education Global, but this is to put open licenses on educational contents. On the other hand, if you learn all your life, you need to have something to prove to other people what you are able to do, what are your competencies and your knowledge. And I think this bounds really well with what we have been doing recently, which is at my University of Lille. We have really transformed the way we issue diplomas. Diploma in the whole world is still a paper. Very slowly it has become a digital certificate, but it's not the main trend. It's only a trend. And there are many people all around the world who are working on blockchain and education, what it would bring to people to have a wallet in which they could find any learning outcomes. And this is the diploma itself. After 3, 4, 5 years, why wait 6 months to have a paper, you know, that doesn't give people the service it should? And on the other hand, other learning outcomes, which is maybe an employer certificate around what you have been doing with them, what you have learned, what you have achieved, so that it's easier for you to find another job. And of course, there is also the question of open recognition. This is around open badges. Open badges are also certificates, and people who have worked for the last 20 years around peer-to-peer recognition of people. Where are you? What have you done in your life that is not recognized formally in a university or by an employer? Your life is not dedicated to your work and not dedicated to your university. There is another life. And this is what we aim to do, not only at my university, but many institutions, is to recognize informal learning and to put a certificate on that. And that it is very easy for anyone to find it in a wallet and share it with anyone for any reason, practically.
So thank you very much. It's very understandable. It's a very concrete example, education and diploma. Nena, Daniel, what are the use case you can talk about?
But before I go, good morning, everybody. Before I go into the use cases, maybe also set also a bit the scene. where are we today? I think you have an excellent overview about, okay, what is digital identity and what is indeed a bit the place of decentralized identity in that aspect. Now, in these current times, we are a bit in the hybrid modus. We came from a centralized identity model where everything was controlled by single big issuers or big companies, governments or big tech. And we are now gradually going into, hopefully, to a decentralized. So the current European digital identity wallet will be a hybrid wallet, including already some decentralized identity components, but not fully decentralized. That is an interesting, but also a very critical moment, because with the hybrid, you can go in both ways. You can go as something, a mean to say, okay, we are decentralized, we respect your privacy, but behind it are the old concepts about data exploitation and all those kind of things. So in our perspective, it needs also to be seen that the hybrid modus needs to go to a really decentralized modus, where the citizen is really in control of his data. And it's not just a gimmick to give you a wallet and say that you are in control and the other side is still controlling everything that you do. We need to go to another model. In that perspective, it's also very important that Europe and the government also plays their right role in that aspect. Now we see that European governments are trying to say, okay, we create your wallet, we give you the wallet, we give you your base identity. That is maybe good in a hybrid modus, but we need to go further. You are the real creator, owner of that wallet. You are the one that creates your identity and that adds attributes. Not something that the government gives to you and can take away from you, because that is, of course, the biggest risk. So to put that in perspective, so we are a bit in that hybrid modus between centralized and decentralized, and hopefully, but that's also an effort that the whole community needs to do, we need to evolve to real decentralized aspects with all the things that you mentioned, with all the benefits. But also, there's also hard, because it's something that is creating a complete new model economically, but also society. Because most tools are into how can I exploit the data, how can I gain access to your data to sell that data. That is the business model that is today. So we need to break that. And that's not will come into something very easily. That is something you need to work on in the complete ecosystem. Currently today, Pirina already mentioned, you have the use cases on education, where we see how we can exchange educational credentials. I'm also working on EPSI Vector, another project that is also looking at social security credentials. I have certain work documents. If I work abroad, I need to present certain data. That process is very cumbersome. If one country are going to work in Italy, the Italian employer need to check in Belgium, do I have health insurance, do I have certain pension rights, and those kind of things. Give that data to the citizen, and then it can be easily transferred. So we see that those what we call a bit verified credential paradigm or verified credential method is something that's very appealing to a lot of businesses. So one use case, you can use it for many use cases. From the case where you're going to say, okay, I have credentials, I need to share with somebody else, it's much easier to give that to the citizens in a trusted way and then have them share it by his means, without third parties trying to interconnect with all those kind of ways. So in basic, it's a simple way. What is the role of the blockchain in that aspect? It's minimal, and it should be kept minimal. Because blockchain is not a tool to store all those credentials, store all those kind of information, so no new honeypot in that sense. No, it's just a trust layer, a very basic trust layer without no knowledge, without too many kind of expertise, but just if I share a credential, that verifier can easily check, yes, that is correct, that came from the right issuer, that came from not revoked, without giving any more information. So that's, I think, what we need to do. But we need to reflect heavily. I think this maybe this conversation can also contribute to that. What is the role of the government in that? We don't want to replace the big tech with the government. We need to have give them a stable and very clear space. The political message in Europe is clear. We want to give citizens more privacy. But you need to see that in the technical aspects, it's also respected. In the hybrid modus, there is a risk. So we need to evolve and set up the next step.
Okay, how to convince the governments? this is the point, actually. When we want to make a revolution, we never start from the governmental side, okay? We need to teach the government how to start to use blockchain technology or all that advanced digital technologies as such. The innovation is usually coming from the companies, from the economy part. And when we show that the model that we use is efficient economic model or business model, then we can convince the governments after a certain period of time that it works. I agree that decentralization is very important. Also, not only for blockchain, because it's a more or less distributed model, but now we can see that also in the other technologies, cloud edge technologies are transforming into decentralized, federated models that can also use the characteristics that are functioning through blockchain technology. So identity here, not only for the citizens, right? We in Slovenia started with the concept how to develop the corporate identity, which would follow the principles of the digital identity of the citizens, but will be also as a tool how to, maybe Perrine was explaining before that the accessibility of the persons, of the knowledge and so on. But here can also be accessibility of the markets, of the new businesses and the recognition on that markets. First step for us was, or a parallel action, was how to integrate or make the different registrars integratable into one umbrella or one agnostic technology, which can serve like the standard under which companies can, like they can act like the holders, or they can act like verifiers, on the other hand. The issuer, we perfectly know, we have the national business registrars, we have the national tax offices, we have the national, many registrars on the national level, but now is the process of integration of those registrars on the European level. So here is a really great opportunity to integrate the technology, that means trusted based, okay, ensures data privacy. We need to be aware that also Digital Market Act and Digital Services Act here very much help to protect that data from abuse and other legislation as well. But on the other hand, accessibility of the data for the companies is also very important. It makes their businesses more agile, more efficient, more productive, and more competitive. So the next big thing, I think that it will be definitely digital identity for the companies that will be also through blockchain, interoperable and accessible all over Europe and in extra Europe areas.
Because yes, we didn't say it, but there's a certain kind of alignment between private interests, public interests, and it's quite rare. It's what you are saying, because we all use standards, common standards, addicted by the W3C, and this is the big innovation behind decentralized identity, I understand. So, yeah.
Yeah. Is it working? Yeah. Let's remember it's very early phase of adoption of this kind of technology, so when people doesn't understand everything, it's normal, don't be afraid. And for now, we have to make people less afraid about this technology. And let's not have this revolution confiscated by... It's nice to say to see governments and education worlds adopt that kind of technology, but we need more small and agile solutions, and solutions that can survive the startups that will bring in on the table. Because decentralized entity means that usually people and small group of people and enterprise can really own their identity, so their profile is the only thing public. And let's make people understand that we are not talking about putting personal information on blockchains, because it's the first misunderstanding when we are thinking, oh, blockchain is everything is public. So no, we are not working on very dystopian tools to make things worse again. You talk a bit about reboot the web of trust. We have lots of people that already know that we should be aware of privacy and personal life to have this kind of important things in mind when you are working on these tools. Just for I want to be short because I want to interact with people, but currently we are working on our own tools to be adopted. They're called MyDID solution, but it's for very even small companies, but even for non-formal groups, because identity is a very large domain. It could be about even foundation, association, a small project with not even a real status. It shouldn't be even publicly declared somewhere on an administration to have a group and to be able to have a public profile. So we help even companies and small teams who have their public profiles and to be able to issue credentials for their members. And most of the time it's about rewarding people, because even in our technical world, we are not very competent. But we jump from project to project, for example. Mm-hmm. And most of the time we don't even take the time to reward people and give them credentials. So we are working on that kind of early phase adoptions. And for the larger group and people that are moving kind of more quickly than government and education. We are working on this use case too, but this is a very slow adaptation, so we are larger.
Okay, great, interesting. And I wanted to add the question, no? Yeah?
Absolutely. So yeah. I've heard a lot of, my name's Evan. I'm co-founder of a project called Disco.xyz. Thank you so much to our hosts for having us today. Really appreciate all of you getting up early this morning to join us. So first, before I dive into some technical terms, just want to check, show of hands if you have a self-custodial crypto wallet. All right, so we are on equal footing here for the most part today. So that's great to know. Now, I heard a lot of well-informed opinions, but what I didn't hear were definitions. So let's start off with some simple definitions so we can all be on equal footing. To me and a disco, decentralized identity is a system in which the subject of data has the most control over it. Not ultimate control. You can't just go ahead and change your eye color on your driver's license if you would like, but when you are the subject of information and you have more control than other parties about it, that meets our definition of sufficiently decentralized identity systems. Secondly, privacy. We heard the word privacy a lot. What is privacy? Privacy is the absence of disclosure. You can facilitate whether data is disclosed or not disclosed if you have the most control over it. And so privacy and decentralized identity go hand in hand. If the only thing I know about you is how much money you have, the only thing we can do together is spend that money. We could give each other loans, we can pool it, but we can't schedule a call because I don't know what time zone you're in. You can't send me a text message because you don't know my phone number or what language I speak. And so if we want to coordinate a more complex activity, such as a gathering like today, if we want to build a party, we want to assign diplomas to some students, we need more information about each other. And so what I'm particularly excited about at Disco is making it easy to collect data from many different facets of your life, multifaceted like your identity and this disco ball, in an app called your data backpack. So your wallet is for your money, and the disco data backpack extends the ability of your crypto keys so they can control tokens and those credentials, attestations, and signatures, other file types, types of data that can describe you. At Disco, we also have built out what we call the on-chain phone book. Now, how many of you remember phone books, the yellow pages, lists of businesses? This is, you know, maybe aging myself a little bit here. But the value of the phone book in our regular world helps us find the correct identifier, the correct public identifier for businesses, for schools, for government agencies, and even for each other. But in a blockchain setting where we've pushed everything to the edges, we become atomic, self-sovereign units unto ourselves. How do we find each other? How do I know the difference between Evan.eth, being me, really Evan, or some random person who decided to buy a namespace similar to mine? And so being able to understand, being able to evaluate the identity and associated trust that we have in different businesses is how we've started to build the phone book, making composable trust easier, or the ability for businesses to build trust quickly with you because you've done business with them before. And the trust that you built together is something I can see and I can rely upon. So we call that trust cost savings or trust composability. So at Disco, we make it easy for you to own, control, manage, and carry around the data that matters so that your day can be faster, cheaper, easier. You can get where you are going already. Collecting identity data under your control, that is not something that any user wants, because it is homework without value. The only reason that people are interested in controlling their data is if they can do another activity more easily or in a more pleasant way. And so we really focus on enabling both enterprises and the organizations they serve, exactly as you noted, to discover one another, to easily understand the holistic nature of their identity, not just how much money they have, but who likes snowboarding, who attended this event here, who's in ECC in Belgium this week.
Excellent. Nice. Thank you very much, Evan, for this. Yeah, I can see that there's effectively an alignment between the public and the public interest and private interest, and this is, I think, very fascinating about decentralized identity. So I declare the discussion open. I don't know how to say that, but don't hesitate to grab the mic and ask your question. Please do the same. Also do the same if you want to ask a question to the audience. Yes?
Yeah. I'm Grace. And as Evan said, it's about what you can do with it and also when it who's controlling it and also who controls the access. And my big concern is about the access of governments. And I'm going to tell two stories about Slovenia, which is where I live. And when I came there during the pandemic, my driver's license ran out from the country of origin, and I went to the administrative unit, which is what we call it over there. And we couldn't figure out online what my rights were. And so I went there, and I sat at the desk with a woman, and she's like, you have to take driving lessons, okay? And you can tell by my age that I probably don't need them. And I said, how many? And she said, the driving teacher will tell you. And that's right, right? There isn't a digital identity that tells me what the rights are. It's the person who's going to give me a driving lesson and the rights of that bureaucrat at that desk to make a judgment call. And like, and that's, you know, the opposite thing happened to me in crypto, and we're a very crypto-friendly organization, and I've always issued my invoices and all of the things that I need to, and I accept money in crypto because I'm in the industry. And one day, the director of my company, because I'm not Slovenian, she's the director, got called into the police because the amount of money we had at the end of the year wasn't the amount of money in euros that we had invoiced for because it was Ethereum and it went up. And she got called into the police for that. And we had all the paperwork in order. We had everything in order. And it's just when it becomes overly digitized, and we've all been in this situation where we actually have the rights to something and we can't get it because all of the digital technologies are in our way. And this is my concern. Like, my concern is that we are going to take away the power of the actual people that we sit across from in the government offices and give it over to these systems which are problematic. And so I'm asking how you, like, how do we address those issues?
Grace, your feelings are valid. That experience is valid. And it's okay to be stressed. That was probably a pretty stressful experience for you. So I think what we're talking about here is not a technical or a government question. What we're talking about is societal development. Back in the 1960s, 1970s, airplanes would be booked to 55% capacity so that you could flexibly change from one flight to another. We call that the almost exact economy. Not one governed by algorithms and programmatic assignment and pricing, but one governed by human discretion, as Grace is describing, exists in some administrative units today. With the introduction of the information age, we have now approached an exactly right economy. No longer nearly right, accommodating for individual discretion, but rather being executed with code. That code is only able to reflect the decisions and input made by the party who wrote it. That code does not have an opinion about you. It simply executes based on the rules it has been given. And so we have an impasse between the almost exact nature of human interaction across cultures, across roles, and the exactly right nature of algorithmic interaction and blockchain-based settlement. So, you know, from DISCO perspective, I had the privilege of meeting and, you know, working with our colleagues at the Bank for International Settlements, who are exploring ZK-EVM L2s that central banks can use to transact with one another and settle to public Ethereum. However, to your point, the nature of those types of executions are financial and specific. They do not pertain to the number of hours that Grace needs to drive in order to be safe in Slovenia on the roads. So I wonder, you know, for our colleagues, the assignment of rights and the individual discretion of government employees are different. How do you think about those with EBSI?
If I can defend Slovenia, right? It's not only Slovenia the case, it's in a lot of the countries. But yeah, in any case, I very much agree with you. We need to... The governments are the most traditional economies, you know. So it will be the long process of transformation. We had some tries to somehow introduce the hybrid cloud model, you know, which will be definitely decentralized based communication and connectivity model using also blockchain technology. We didn't pass through, you know, because there is very strong centralization within the government. So the first step that will be how to motivate the governments to embrace that decentralized approach. This is the most important. The second is how to integrate new technologies. Everybody is talking about ChatGPT. We have courses. We have everything, but we are not there. So ChatGPT cannot solve the universe, and also it can be very basic tool for also for the data collection and transmission.
Question. I love your suggestion there that LLMs can help us more easily interpret large sets of written data, such as the legal code. Do you think that that's the type of resource that would help the identities of citizens understand their rights if we had the ability to chat with and ask questions to a set of our law instead of having to interact with an individual who may not have expertise in every line of that law?
Maybe if I can react to that, that's not enough. It's clearly not enough, because it's a nice model. You put the citizen in control of everything, but he's alone or she is alone in that aspect. You're now facing other big parties that interact. So it's a very asymmetrical relationship that you have in that sense. Somebody, a big bank, a big company can say, okay, give me all your data. Where are you as a citizen to say, no, I don't want to do that? You have a bit the classical image that they give. What do you refuse to 500-pound gorilla? Yeah? You give them everything. You're not going to say, sorry, I'm not going to share that. You are denied to services, you're denied to those kind of things. So we need to help that citizens, and we as government, as society, to put that in a more symmetrical way, to have that balance that you can have the means to say, okay, no, I don't share that kind of data, or that are my rights. The current means are not sufficient in digital society. You need other ways. I don't have an answer on those kind of things, but we need to find a way, and Europe GDPR is not enough. The only thing that you do is clicking on you accept cookies. That's not enough to protect yourself into the digital society. What if somebody abuses you? What if somebody steals your wallet? What if somebody doesn't have right to your medical data? Because you have a lot of power, you can share everything with everybody. So how do we deal with those kind of things? So it's not an answer to your question, but I share your concern that we need to find other ways to deal with those kind of things. If not, we put every citizen at risk. And everything is possible in digital. You don't know what the algorithm is doing, you don't know what you do with your data, and so on and so on, so you need more transparency. And I think regulation, it's a European answer, I know, but regulation needs to be there, more to protect it, and more hard thing. Because at the current pace, you have fines for Facebook or whatever, it's not enough. You need to see how we deal with those kind of things. But this is a concern that we need to address.
But maybe to respond, it can be a source because we can create many sources from many data points, okay, or data entries. But in any case, we need to follow the multi-layer approach, if you want, and see what is that trustful data that we extract from each type of source, right? And what is the reputation concern connected with this data, right? How we can believe to the source through the use of the technology. And this is, for me, a milestone that we should follow, how to define that multi-layer approach.
That's a great point. We exist in a hyper-trustful society. If you did not write the code and compile it, you're trusting someone. If you didn't build the hardware from the minerals, you are trusting someone. If you did not write the data yourself originally, you are trusting whoever signed it.
I just wanted to add a word. As I am a civil servant, I don't like too much criticism around bureaucrats because it all depends on education and trainings, I think. For example, and management, of course. For example, when I came with my ideas around blockchain, of course, people thought I was a fool. But at some point, someone listens, say, okay, let's do it. So we have issued already 60,000 certificate of completion of the diploma at my university. And you think verifiable credential and the infrastructure is so important, but no, not at all. Because real people, the bureaucrats I am working with, they had so many good ideas and we transformed the diploma. We didn't just take the technology and do something out of certification of the diploma. No, it's just one of the features of our new reinvented diploma in the 21st century, as the MIT and the Digital Credential Consortium wrote it in the white book. So if you let people work around a project, like what would be better to exploit the data of your diploma? What will it be in future for your driving license? What can be the supplemental service we give to people? This begins to be really interesting. And then it has been 1 year, we are training everyone that is directly in charge of issuing the diploma in each faculty of the university. So you see, it's a huge process, and I see so many times governments or people or companies saying, yes, the technology is great, we're going to do it, and not taking care of the human beings. I mean, not only the citizen as a user or end user, but the bureaucrats themselves are human. So let's not just uberize society, but give people a better job, more interesting than verifying a diploma that have been stored for 50 years, which is happening every day in every university of the world.
Great. I have one question here.
Yes, I just wanted to follow up on what you were saying about we need to reinvent something. And when data are more and more a commercial value, you know, and it's the future of our business model, if we want to reinvent something, there's maybe something about putting a clear limit about personal data that should not be commercialized, you know? Is there something like that? I mean, is there anyone who has ideas about...
I disagree. I like this idea because it's spicy, right? Are there certain types of data we should not monetize? I believe that I should have the right to do whatever I want with my data. If I want to sell it and I can find a buyer, I think I should have the right to transact with independence. I think the freedom to transact is one of the most fundamental freedoms. However, I also see that there are sensitive types of data for which there may be, you know, additional protections or commercial requirements. So, for example, in the United States, there have been lawsuits regarding period tracker apps, menstrual trackers that women use. Women are more likely to make purchasing decisions when they're ovulating. So companies have purchased the period tracker data apps and then assigned different ads to consumers so that they will buy more, manipulating them based on their hormonal cycle. This is very effective, but also very problematic, and so a number of these companies did indeed pay fines. But because there was no law there, they've just started doing it again. So we have limited regulations around medical data that is self-attested, around data that does not have appropriate disclosures. But thus far, I have never seen a limitation on what an individual is permitted to disclose to a counterparty of their own volition, and I don't think there should be.
Yeah, and this is the difference between US and Europe, because in Europe, you are protected by yourself, you know? Certainly, you cannot sell them, because it's sensitive data, it's medical data, for example, and you are not allowed to trade with them.
So, certainly, there's the sale of the clear text data itself. You can retain a copy of the data and sell the right to compute upon it. You can sell access to models, such as we see with RDAT. So you guys might be familiar with RDAT that allows users to contribute data from their own Reddit profile. That data remains encrypted, so it's never seen, doesn't violate any of those concerns. However, you get paid when others compute upon that encrypted data, the right to compute. So we need to separate access to clear text, plain data from access to learn about it, access to send a model to compute on it, access to the insights that it creates. And so when we talk about access to data, there are actually many, many different ways that can be achieved and monetized within the bounds of HIPAA, GDPR, CCPA, and other laws.
I'm sure it exists, but I would call again for like an ethical discussion and forum about the question of data, because it's not possible that it can be only this type of discussion. It has to be a higher level.
Oh, you're right, actually. Maybe one clear example that I like to think about with diplomas is why, you know, the example you described in Lille works wonderfully for your community, has been adopted by the administrators and embraced by the students, but that would not be safe to replicate in the United States. It would not be ethical. For example, if I went to a historically black college or university and issued public credentials to all those students, I would be publicly marking the wallets of ethnic minorities. Now, what happened in Europe when we publicly marked ethnic minorities? How did that go? So I agree that there are certain types of data that are ethical to publicize when access control is the goal, and certain types of data that are not ethical. But I think it's important for us to interpret and embrace the context and space in which that happens, because it's not going to be the same in every country, exactly as you correctly noted.
My name is Omar. I'm curious about how conceptually decentralized identity or self-sovereign identity competes with non-blockchain enabled digital identity. And the context for that question is that coming back to Evan's point, the issuers, the most important issuers, are likely to be centralized, whether they're governments, universities, and so on. And today, in multiple countries, you have already these digital identity apps where your identity is somehow on an application, and these are starting to interoperate with services within the said country. And it works fairly well. So what is the core of the narrative here for why blockchain? Why should your identity be on the blockchain?
Regarding this, you talked a bit about kind of hybrid solutions that we got now. So, and let's not forget that actors that are already very well functioning identity system will not be eager to adopt that kind of new solutions. But even governments and schools could and should have very different profiles on very different, let's say, blockchains on decentralized world. And I'm okay, even decentralized identifiers, the standards are not pushing for public blockchains everywhere. You can kind of mix the solutions, like having your public profiles on your website, but it brings some kind of centralized point of failure because it's about your website. You say, oh, we can have some kind of bridge between the decentralized identities and the profiles with the certificates that are given by governments, because we have already well-structured centralized authorities that are afraid of decentralized identity solutions and that shouldn't, because they should understand that we can collaborate, because if they are just are fighting these new kind of solutions, I think they will lose at the long term. So just to say that you are not forced to use public blockchains, but you can, and you can have even for existing actors, you can have multiple profiles. So it's not everything is not fighting each other on this world. So even hybrid solutions, we are working on it, learning, making centralized authorities to understand how they can put their certificate online and certified and this kind of public profiles. Then we are already working on that kind of hybrid solutions, like you say.
And maybe to add to that, that's indeed completely right. But the main difference is that in those models that you mentioned, the other aspect, there is a connection between the verifier and issuer. There is a certain way, even in a third party line of things, the issuer knows who is verifying things. So with the blockchain solution, we try to break that kind of thing. That is a first principle of privacy. Another big important aspect is that those kind of solutions normally work, if I look at the market, into specific business domains. You have a solution for banks, you have a solution for governments, you have a solution that works, but you don't see any real cross-border, cross-sector solutions. That is not allowed by legislation. You cannot have the solution where a bank, as a verifier, directly access information in the government. Luckily, that's not allowed. And vice versa, it's also not allowed. So that model, that old model, only works if you share bank information with banks and banks check it themselves. That's you need agreement. But if you want to scale that up, it's getting immense complex. So you need another system that not every issuer needs to agree with every verifier, okay, I'm going to interact with the data. So you need a more scalable model that puts it, okay, use it from in the holder. And that is why blockchain is just in the layer, but it's also about making more flexible. And those hybrid solutions are seeing also the complexity of the world, and you need to address that in a different way.
I think we can keep it simple. To your question, identity does not need blockchain. Blockchain needs identity if you want to coordinate anything beyond treasury allocation.
No, but maybe if we look to the future, okay, all that identities are developed on Web 2, right? The requirements of Web 3 will require many more addition of the technologies and so on. So blockchain can be a very useful thing or tool how to ensure or how to minimize additional requirements for security, for to ensure data privacy, for integrity of the data, for authentication. It's all attributable to blockchain, and all will be required within Web3 environment. We have the solutions that are automatically changing identities from Web2 to Web3 through the telephone numbers. you know, the PIN codes and so on. Now we are on the way to Web3, but all the supporting technologies, and the blockchain is one of them, definitely will take or be taken into account very seriously in the future development. Yeah.
So I need to step back two more or three conversations back, because that really sparked, you know, heartbeat in me. People need knowledge about data so they can make a decision, and they need choice to be able to make a decision. And really, it's about people don't think about data and they don't think about their digital identity, but if we are already seeing that that is going to be that our digitalizing economies are run on, then we don't just need financial literacy that is very poor, we need also data literacy, and it has to start in the beginning. People need to be, you know, come to the idea that the data is not the fingernail that you clipped off and anyone can have it, but it might be your organs, right? So you might, even if you, and especially that's because, let's face it, people are, or majority of the people living on Earth are really disadvantaged when it comes to access to money. And if that, you know, if you're building systems that actually runs on that, because people have no choice because they need the money, stuff like WorldCoin is, you know, the worst that can happen. And the only way I see there really be a discussion about that is when people learn, yeah? And my question would be, how do we get there? Like, not about which technology is the best, but what does data, what is my data, my identity, how am I building it? Literally education and literacy.
Sorry, if I can react to that, you're right. But it's more complex than that. I don't think really that you having multiple, multi-complex processes that you will not be able to understand as a citizen. Who am I interacting to? What are the consequences of the data that I share with that kind of company that I don't know? So you will need smart tools to help you with that. It will be also, sorry to say that, a world where machine, agent to agent, will discuss in behalf of yourself. You need smart wallets to do that. Because we thought, indeed, let's convince people that they don't want to share data. Let's convince, try to educate what happens with that data. It's getting more complex. You have heard some kind of methods that they are using. How do you protect citizens with that? I don't think that it will be only education. You need smart tools that help you on those kind of things. That say, okay, this is an unsafe interaction. Don't do this. This is violating your rights. So I think maybe the startups and all the people that are developing wallets, there is a market. How make a tool that can protect yourself against all those threats that are there? Because it is a warfare to do those kind of things. Education is interesting and helpful, but it's getting, you need more tools. The world is getting so complex.
Yes, if we learn people to own their data, I think the first thing we should say to them, say, don't sell it. I know you are controversial voluntarily, but just say that because people don't understand what we can do with sending you, most of the time you're sending your data once and they are there forever. In the future, we can probably ask, perhaps inside standards, verifier what they are engaged to do with the data that we are sharing to them. But most of the time we are thinking about personal data because we want, as a private actor, say, okay, let's take that private data and give it to these algorithms and they will buy things that we are pushing to them. Just for, you were talking about smart wallets, we can reverse thinking on some points. For example, if you have wallets that understand locally who you are, because you are giving them lots of information about yourself, we can think about a world with your wallet locally knows who you are and will grab information that will well fit it to you by themselves. You can give up the centralized point of information about you. So we will have in the future new tools to get rid of parts of centralized actors. I don't think we managed, of course, to give up completely, but we have the tools now.
I would like to end. Yes, people need money, but people need identity too. And if you have been in some context where there is no electricity and there is no tool and there is nothing, there are still projects that I think are smart with giving back identity or back or give an identity to orphans, for example, who have where in some part of countries where you have absolutely no ledgers of any kind. And if you don't begin by the identity, you have no first name, actually. You can be a girl and get no education, or get education, but if you have no official recognition, how to deal with that later? And you will be the victim of organ traffics or terrorism because you have no identity, so you don't count really. So there are projects with blockchain technology to really give the power to one schoolmaster to just take picture and begin somewhere, you know, to give identity to children that have absolutely none. Yes, there are. And of course, this pays for education too, because if you begin at school, then you have some learning outcomes too, and it's a beginning of something. It's better than nothing.
Maybe to get back to...
Can I just say something? Like, you don't need to give people identity. Please. Like, just the way we're speaking, like, you can give people identity is such an inhumane phrase. So please just watch how you're talking about it. Like, you don't get to give a child an identity.
They're born with one. Every person has had an identity since the day they were born, but the databases...
Yeah, of course, it's an official identity, but we are in a society where it's quite normal, but in other parts of the world, I have heard stories about children without a first name, which they are slaves.
But that is a fundamental thing, eh? That is how Europe is looking at those kind of things. Currently, today, in the European Digital Identity Wallet, you get a wallet, and you get from the government, and you get your base identity. This is a very core, and that is fundamentally, in my mind, wrong. Because you as a citizen, as a human,
so
you created yourself and then add attributes. That's completely different. But that's the hybrid modus that we need to switch.
I think we're talking about the difference between an identity and an identifier.
So an identifier is given to you from the government. That is even not... Identity and identifier, we are past that. Because some countries thought you need an identifier, you need a unique number, but it's not even that. It's about, creating that complete identity, your wallet, complete solution, your digital...
Database entry in a government database. Whatever we want to call that noun, totally hear you, that in different languages, these words mean different things, and that can be very personal because identity is a very personal topic. So heard, and I think we can all reflect on how our different cultures use different languages, and that can cause conflict or can cause misunderstanding when we talk to people from different backgrounds. So I think you noted something really important here, where even regardless of the edge cases, we don't think about edge, or if we're not talking about edge cases or government function, but rather talking about media literacy, which I think was your original question. How do we educate media literacy as a community? How do we acknowledge that that might be a valuable topic? And I think what you imply there in that question is that data is labor. That data has value. So the generation of value done by the act of existing, right? Because that data describes you because you exist. That intrinsically has merit in an economic exchange. And so when we assume that, right, that what we're talking about is your autonomy and your ability to assert yourself in your community based on the data that you have, how can we create a literate community to allow people to feel empowered there, where we're not giving them crazy amounts of homework and asking them to understand really complicated, unfair things, while also making their lives easier, making it easier for students or folks who don't have, you know, the, all of the resources that we might have enjoyed to still have the same set of opportunities. So I agree, there are a lot of, you know, niche policy actions, that some that exist, some that don't, some verbiage that may work, some that doesn't, but fundamentally we are asking, is data a right of the body that you create, or is data a business value asset that others can negotiate upon?
Yes, yes. We need to make a difference between formal identity, what is in identity wallet or prescribed by the regulatory frameworks, and the identity that we create through our behavior, through our relation, not only business but social as well, because in different areas, for example, if in non-banked, you can create the profile according to your behavior, how you build the trust in the community, and so on. And maybe to the lady here in the green jacket, you decide by yourself how much data you will create and put in the ether, you know, to be accessible by the public. You can have the identity like you are a consumer, for example, through loyalty programs and so on. Everybody, or most of the people, I'm not, and this was a very conscious decision not to be a member of any loyalty program, because this is the perfect source how they different providers use the data, how you behave, or what lifestyle do you have, everything that can describe you by the descriptive criteria. So it depends on each individual how much data creates about himself or herself and how much data he's willing to put on market, if I express like this.
Just for to clarify things for people, I think we should use plurals a lot more regarding identities. Wallets are dealing with identities, several identities. You can create identities by yourself. And yes, we should be aware that if we are forced to have all our data linked to a centralized identifier that we were given by a centralized authority, yeah, it could be a single point of failure regarding privacy, that kind of thing, and correlation. But let's think about having each people having the ability to have lots of identities and just not one.
Can I build on that? Because if we look at what digitization brought us, then first we helped to digitize the jobs from traffic cops. And we got a landscape full of speed cameras, and now sort of an additional road tax that we have to pay whenever we exceed driving beyond like 3 kilometers too fast. We digitized tax offices, which led to a systemic failure in the Netherlands, robbing over 1,500 families of their kids because they were fined for having government grants that they were supposedly, according to the system, not entitled to. We introduced filters on the internet to battle child pornography, which are now used to battle whatever big players deem to be illegal content.
It's not working, by the way. So.
No, well, the thing is, it's working. The question is for who? And my concern with digital identities is that we're opening Pandora's box, because as a digital society, we're very childish and immature. Do we actually believe that we have the responsibilities and the capabilities to deal with these technologies in a responsible way? I'm not so sure. I'm curious what you guys think.
The box is already open. So if we're
not
here,
not an excuse,
who else is?
Too late for that question. Right?
Yeah, I think Pandora's box has been opened. I agree. I think many of these technologies are beginning to show what negative externalities happen when we are not thoughtful about those, what those externalities can be. And so if we were not here having this discussion, it would proceed unfettered. So my thought is, you know, I'm grateful that we're all willing to engage in this topic. I agree that it is a challenging set of goals ahead of us, one that's likely to require ethical guardrails that have not yet been articulated. There is no Hippocratic oath of builders to do no harm to those you serve with your products. But I'm hoping that questions like that will invite us to rise to the occasion and do so.
Hi, I'm Sean from IXO. So what I found to be a useful sort of mental model around identifiers is that they're accounts that we have. So your national identity number, for instance, is the account that you have with government. And each of the providers of the accounts, if it's a third party that is giving you your account, provides you with a bunch of services and is responsible for what they do with your data. And so under regulations like GDPR, you know, that's a lot more regulated. The self-issued identifiers, where you create a non-custodial account, also has a certain range of services and rights and things you can do with it. So, you know, I think that's a useful distinction when talking about why blockchain and versus central identities and so on. Some of these accounts are custodial and others are non-custodial, in the same way as we think about blockchain accounts for transactions, for financial transactions. And then in terms of data, we must always think of the counterfactuals as well. So I do a lot of work in Africa, for instance, where people just don't have information about themselves. And that's a huge cause of exclusion from all kinds of things, whether it's financial services, education, work opportunities, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, I think that there are some ideological things here, and there's different ways. We're kind of talking about at cross purposes, I think, sometimes when we're mixing identifiers with accounts, with regulations, and so on. And it'd be useful to speak of those, you know, each in their own sort of right.
Maybe kind of a spicy American take on some of those elements that you described, and I think this kind of gets into what we were talking about earlier as well. So, from a regulatory perspective, business leaders who are in charge of data have a couple competing interests that they need to serve where I work in the United States. There exists what's called fiduciary duty, or the obligation of an executive to make as much money as physically possible if they operate a business. And then separately, there is the, I believe it is the Citizen Information Security Act of 1972 that obligates the right to be let alone and defines citizen data as protected data in classes similar to businesses. So at once, there is an obligation to access as much data as possible to optimize the business while also respecting the set of boundaries that have been established around what you can do with that data. And so therein lies a tension. It's not that that business leaders desire to harm their users. It is that they are being pulled in two separate directions, both being told this is your legal obligation, and if you don't do it, you are in big trouble.
Thank you. I think there will always be negative externalities to all, you know, digital innovation. The question is, how can we put the opportunities and the values, you know, as in the driving seat, but also people who actually are not benefiting from those developments in the driving seat, and how can we use digital identity as an opportunity also to challenge the system? And one of these opportunities to me, and Frederick, you mentioned this, is about creating the new system for peer-to-peer recognition and reward and linking it to the financial system as well. This is going to change how we think about the work of the associations, how we think about the work of the networks, because currently we only have the government, we have private sector, and everything is in between, you know, it's kind of a gray area. So I think digital identity and how we think about peer-to-peer work is, to me, as a breakthrough. I wonder how you think, maybe Frederick, you could elaborate like about what systems do we need to put this in place. I'm also imagining how this could change the way we contract, like for example, in the context of the government, there is a social contracting mechanism when we can actually contract individuals or organizations from, you know, civil society for work. The thing is that how do we look at their credentials is usually based on how the government qualifies them, but not on how citizens or peers qualify them, right? So digital identity is gonna shape how, you know, if we create a network and if we recognize each other as peers and the government uses this mechanism, we can basically kind of, you know, change the system. So to me, these are the breakthrough opportunities in terms of like where the system currently doesn't function and the opportunities where we could go. also agree with Frederic that this is also an area that is underdeveloped, because this is like smaller solutions and also requires bringing in the groups that are not traditionally part of this circle of discussions. So to me, and this is where we work of kind of bridging the gap between civil society and innovation and government and the donors. So I'm looking forward for those kind of solutions that are also challenge the status quo and kind of present new opportunities for the system.
Very quickly, you're right to say that we mostly addressed drawbacks, and but there are two opportunities. And thank you to I don't remember his name for bringing this. So, mostly with the talk about having too much information, but we are systems and people that don't have access to rights because they don't have the capability of proving things, simple things about themselves. And the second kind of opportunities that I like to talk a lot, but I won't here too much, it's about having more opportunity to have recommendation on the peer-to-peer levels and not like some very top-down things like... and for example, when we are explaining things to a small community, say, "Oh, you will be able to have to give rewards to active members to and that kind of thing." Say, "Oh, but also allow people to have peer-to-peer recommendations, and we should facilitate that so people can be proud and flex about their." Recommendations on the peer-to-peer level. A mad thing for me, it's to always, even if I want to publicly show that I recommend people on a special knowledge, for now I have to think, oh, perhaps I should use LinkedIn to have that kind of recommendation. It makes me mad. So we have the opportunities to have more peer-to-peer recommendation too.
Maybe just to mention that, I think it's an interesting sideway, yeah, because we are talking there indeed between gov interaction, official interaction with banks and those kind of thing. But there's indeed a bigger world outside. If I look at how young people are doing that in the game world, they are creating those kind of things. Who do I trust? Who do I play with? What are the credentials of that co-player? That's a complete other way. And all those things about the IDAS and the EUDI, they don't matter in that kind of thing. They are already set in that
exactly, mindset. And then what are the opportunities to link it to the payment system, so to the financing with the government? You know, if I am recognized as a social worker, an outreach worker that my community trusts, then how can I get funding from the government, let's say, for certain? So it's rethinking the payments.
But it's also a bit parallel world, because you say government, but if you see that they're interacting, they're interchanging tokens already today, values that they have, they want to go across gaming, it's already happening today. In the gaming industry, I see that tokens and all those blockchain solutions are a part of that. They don't discuss what is the use of blockchain, do we need it? It's part of that. It's past those kind of things. And it will be the same in maybe in the metaverse and whatever it will be. Those kind of solution will be a part of it. No?
I completely agree. It's already here. It's just not equally distributed. From airdrops to OnlyFans to gaming, we know that P2P payments and reputation are already driving new types of behavior.
I might have a question. I'm William, and I'm quite new in Brussels, and I start a new career as a public affairs consultant. So I might want to know what is at stake for you and the digital... decentralized ID within the EU policies within the next months, years, and what do you expect from our political groups?
It's nice, a closing question, maybe. What do you expect? Hey, you need to put pressure that is going into the right direction. Huh? I talked about that hybrid modus. It can go both ways. Huh? It can go back again to the old world that they initiate, okay, back to centralized, back to the kind of thing. But we have a solution. They are now including in the UDI verified credentials. That's the first steps. And they are considering to use blockchain as a means of verification. So that's a very first victory, to say so. But the base identity, the wallet, is constructed very centralized. You will get... If you're a Belgian citizen, you will get from the Belgian government your wallet and your base identity, and that will be there. Hopefully it will evolve that the Belgian government will not issue the wallet and have control of the wallet, and also don't link it too hard between the identifier that you mentioned. So hopefully we'll get all the solutions and that you create your own identifier and then your base identity is just added as an attribute. But that's an evolution that we hopefully see in 3 to 4 years. That's not the active solution today. That will be something that hopefully with the wisdom and with the pressure of the society that demands more privacy can be enabled.
Yeah, I agree with you. We are here, we started with, it took us 5 years, I think, until we came to verifiable credentials and blockchain as a foundation technology for also EUDI wallet. But faster we go towards Web3, towards Web4, more we use or regulate or push AI and other technologies that can be compatible, that can converge, right? More decentralized approach is foreseeable, or it has a potential to be used. We can expect some mature solutions also from the side of the European Commission, because the concept is what is adopted by the European Commission then is spread on the countries. So maybe in next 5 years period, some moves will be made also in this way, to use more decentralized approach, use more interoperable approach. You are probably familiar also with that European white paper, how to integrate or boost the connectivity systems in Europe. So the infrastructure will enable all the solutions that we will be interoperable and used for that kind of transactions.
Maybe a last question, or two last questions.
Okay. Yeah.
Maybe Semnem first, and then you, okay?
Okay, so first of all, thank you very much for this conversation. It's really light bulbs went up and heartbeats went up too. So, and I really liked also the what I take with me is, it's also again about externalities. So we know if we don't have sovereignty over identity or data, it's a massive loss of value, immeasurable, but also we don't have fiduciary duty to also care for those values. There is a model of integrated capitals assessment, which really just lists the capitals, which is natural capital, human capital, social capital, what we agree on value, that kind of things, and then produced capital. And financial capital is just produced capital. Data might be just produced capital. So my question is, how hard will it be to actually make such an integrated capitals assessment the basis for fiduciary duty of businesses and policymakers?
I've never done it before. I'll try it. Seems like it could be hard, but we'll give it a shot.
Yeah.
Hi. My name is Sunil. I come from one of those countries which has hardly got any digital identifiers. What you were saying back in Africa, I work with the blind community, which is the most marginalized. I'm also a techie, so I've mixed the both. Now, the comment I would like to make with Daniel's point was, we had this problem 15 years ago in India. We didn't have bank accounts. What we have done is, we've got this India stack, which is something that you can, as a takeaway from here, take a look at. 2009, India built this India stack, which has now got almost 1.2 billion citizens identified. When I say identified, just not born, they got a track, they got an eKYC, they have bank accounts syncing with the government. What you mentioned, that if I go to write for a bank account, I don't talk to the government. That's opened up now. There's a bridge which is now allowing a bank sitting somewhere in the corner of India, talking with the central government to find out registry, etc. This is just a comment. The other point I would like to make is what Evan was talking about. We are all at ETH, and I was at L2. Why not have communities and developers build trust, what you were pointing out? The last piece is, I think, the most important thing is, as developers and as communities, If we don't build trust between us and the government and show to the government can make money on us by making these applications, by making these suitable transactions that can also earn money to the government, I think that will open up much better pipelines for the reverse flow, because the government ultimately needs to talk back to the citizens.
Show me the incentives, I'll show you those outcomes.
Excellent. 90 minutes is definitely too short. thank you so much for this discussion. We have to get a break before diving into this next conversation. Food, water, energy, and supply chain. So thank you very much for your implication. It was really meaningful. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.